Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the March Madness version of the FIA Group's Empowering Plans webinar. We're excited to be here. We're excited that it's now springtime. The weather outside here in Boston is a beautiful 27 degrees, not Celsius, Fahrenheit, right, Ron?
Balmy.
It's balmy 27. It's absolutely amazing. And we're expecting temperatures to stay this way, I think, for like the next 10 days,
if we're lucky.
Anyways, guys, with me, as always, is my senior VP, good friend, and general counsel of FIA, Ron Peck. Say hello, Ron.
Hello, Ron.
And another person who's typically at our webinars, John Jablon, our director of provider relations.
Good afternoon.
And back by popular demand, the guy that we just can't get rid of from these webinars, our Trump expert, our D.C. insider, the guy who spends all day and night in Capitol Hill. Say hello to Brady Bizarro. Brady?
Hello.
Guys, we're very excited today. We have a lot to talk about, and just reading the title, there's a lot to talk about. The medical bill blues, prepayment, contracting, and negotiation, pricing alternatives, and post-payment recovery of overpayment. Basically, what we're mean to say there is, we're going to talk about how to reduce the overall cost of the bill, overall charges, overall cost, what you actually pay out of pocket. But in addition to that, we're going to spend a good amount of time, and that's why Brady is here, is talking about President Trump, all the stuff that's happening in D.C., the potential repeal of Obamacare, the replace or repair options. We're going to talk about all that as well as we get into this, because until all that's resolved, we really don't feel we can have a webinar or a podcast where we don't bring it up to some extent. Speaking of podcasts, we actually just had a podcast go live. I think it was our fifth one.
Yeah.
And we're doing another one that will be coming out within the next 2 weeks as well, specifically tied to what's going on in D.C., and we'll be interviewing Brady for that. So, here are the speakers for today. I just introduced all of them. Obviously, myself, Ron, John, and Brady. Feel free to email us, any one of us, but specifically go to Ron if you need to. Pick anybody. He doesn't have that much to do on a daily basis. Also, feel free to email us through the chat box. Send us any questions you have. If we have time or if we feel it's relevant during the actual presentation, we'll just call some people out. We'll bring up their questions, and hopefully we'll give you an answer if you can.
And by the way,
we're already being told.
Our first question of the day is telling us that it's 80 degrees in Dallas, so thanks.
And this person, I'm not going to say her name, she's at a TPA in Texas, in Dallas, actually. So she likes to send us stuff every single month. I think she thinks we're going to give her something, some kind of gift or something. But, Joni, you're not getting anything from us, so keep on sending those questions in. Anyways, what we want everyone to know that we have an email, pgcreferral@fiagroup.com, available for all your consulting needs. Again, almost all of the stuff that we discuss is specifically related to the top questions that we get on PGC Referral. So it's easy to use. We get that. Victoria will respond to you right away in regards to any questions that you have. But last month, Jablon, I'm going to pass it over to you. Last month, these were the questions that people asked, and John is going to spend a little time talking about them.
Yeah, thanks, Adam. Last month, the three most popular questions included two about COBRA specifically, which is interesting. And in my mind, the reason for that is because the trend is, of course, higher and higher charging. And COBRA becomes more and more relevant because once someone's off the plan, a lot of the times the mentality is, well, we don't have to cover them anymore, right? Well, that's not always the case. There are, of course, instances where a person will continue plan coverage under COBRA. And I am going to breeze through these because we've got a lot to talk about today, and especially Brady. But the first question here, can terminated employees be offered different plan options under COBRA than the plan options offered to active employees? The simple answer to that is essentially, in general, no. The regulations require that the coverage options offered to non-COBRA beneficiaries be the same as those offered to COBRA beneficiaries. The exception would be a qualified beneficiary's right to modify coverage due to an open enrollment or HIPAA special enrollment right. Actually, Section 602 of ERISA provides that coverage must be, and I quote, identical to the coverage provided under the plan to similarly situated beneficiaries under the plan with respect to whom a qualifying event has not occurred. In other words, if you're offering someone COBRA, you cannot just create a special tier of benefits for COBRA beneficiaries. You cannot do it. It's not that simple. If you have questions about COBRA, and we all have questions about COBRA, feel free to give us an email.
Hey, real quick on that. You'll notice this, friend. A lot of the stuff that we're going to talk about today, which includes this COBRA issue that, you know, John so eloquently talked about, a lot of the stuff today is about our clients, TPAs, brokers, trying to find ways to reduce costs by being innovative. The problem is sometimes they just go too far and don't realize that there are issues that preclude them from doing these things, such as discriminatory issues being one of them, or network contract issues, whatever it might be. So all we're asking, whether you use us or someone else, before you just implement it, make sure it's compliant.
Thanks, Adam. And I know that this is a little bit out of order, but since we were just talking about COBRA, I'm going to skip ahead to the third question here. Can an employer prevent a third party from paying COBRA premiums? That is a question that we get constantly, and we have for years, and for whatever reason, again, in February, it was an incredibly, incredibly common question. And the short answer is no. COBRA regs were modified a long time ago, and they basically said that any third party can pay COBRA premiums on behalf of the beneficiary. The result is that employers are generally prohibited from placing restrictions on who can pay a member's COBRA premium. It might be notable, but it's likely not relevant to the reason that many of you out there have asked, but there can be potential tax implications for the third-party payer and the member in situations like this.
Yeah, you know, this question comes up, and we don't necessarily receive it from our client, the information, but we're aware that there are many instances where the actual provider of medical services is the one who's offering to pay the premiums in order to keep the patient on COBRA, because they know that if this person leaves their private plan and, let's say, goes to Medicare, that the amount of reimbursement that's going to go to the provider will seriously shrink. And so they will convince their patient to stay on their private plan and that it, quote, unquote, won't cost them anything because the provider will pay the premium. In those instances, and we've had this happen in the past, the employer, the plan administrator, TPA, they'll notify the patient that, yes, indeed, the provider or anyone else for that matter can pay the COBRA premium, but that they should be aware that by having that debt, that obligation, that financial responsibility of premium covered by a third party, they may potentially have to report that as taxable income, just like a bonus, a holiday bonus. And often that's enough to get them to turn the provider down and go ahead and consider Medicare after all.
Thanks, Ron. And last but not least, in February's most frequently asked questions, an employer's cafeteria plan has a health FSA component. A carryover provision was elected instead of a grace period. How does the health FSA carryover impact HSA eligibility? Of these three questions, this is the most complicated. The potential for overlap between HSA and FSA carryover does present some challenges, but there are options available to make sure you're compliant and HSA eligible. It's important to note that unlike a grace period, an FSA carryover will generally make an individual ineligible to contribute to an HSA for the entire plan year, which can become pretty major. Simply put, in order to eliminate issues with the carryover, there are a couple of main options. Individuals can waive or decline the carryover before the end of the year, meaning that the FSA carryover amount is essentially forfeited, or the carryover amount can be moved to an HSA-compatible health FSA. And like I said, this is a little bit complicated. There's a lot to it. If you have specific questions, please do not hesitate to reach out. We deal with HSAs and FSAs and everything else related to self-funding a great deal, and we can answer any questions that you may have. And I'm going to turn this back over to Adam, who's going to talk about some more fun stuff.
So really quick, folks, just so everyone knows, one of the key things that we realize over the past couple years is that many of our clients, many of our broker and TPA self-funded employer clients, basically want a best practices plan document. We call it the flagship of these are the options. We limit the number of options that are available. So instead of 25 different definitions of a workers' comp exclusion, there's one. So we have put this together in a Word document format. Just so all of you know that I actually do some work around here at FIA, I have actually volunteered to code this plan doc into our plan document management software, our PDM software. I am working on it, and I will have this done and tested by June. So if any of you want to look at something like this, in the meantime, while we have it in Word doc form, it's available for purchase. but we will also have this as part of our plan document software available to all our clients in June. So obviously you can feel free to contact me or Tim Callender in that regard. Next but not least, I want to, one more important thing for everyone to know. We would love for you to follow FIA, the FIA group, on LinkedIn. We're doing our best. Myself and Ron have a bet of how many actual followers we can get. We set a certain date, and basically Ron and I, it's a lot of money on the line. So we really would appreciate as many of you, the thousands of you that are listening today, to please go on LinkedIn, follow the FIA group. We appreciate the fact that you follow Ron, myself, Brady, and John individually, but we really want you to follow our company because that's where we share all the pertinent news on a daily basis in regards to this. So at the end of the day, feel free to do that and touch base with us if you have any issues in regards to how to do that as well. So we're going to turn it now back to me on an overview. What are we going to talk about? The political climate, what's going on? Today's a big day, obviously. We're going to talk about claim negotiations, our favorite topic of all, reference-based pricing. People still don't know what this is. It's funny. Depending on where you are in the country, I did a speech in Florida last week. When I asked the brokers in the audience how many of them have heard of reference-based pricing, 90% of the people raised their hand. When I was in Michigan yesterday and I asked the same exact question, 10% of the people raised their hand. So it really is depending on where you are in the country as to how big or small reference-based pricing has taken off in that particular state. We're going to talk about partial reference-based pricing, which is every plan. Basically, you're a network plan, trust me, you got some partial reference-based pricing built in there. Last but not least, we're going to talk about overpayments. But first and foremost, we're going to give a political update. Brady, take it away.
Thanks, Adam. Well, as I'm sure most of you know by now, the name of the new health care bill that is floating around is called the American Health Care Act. So it was unveiled on March 6th, which is the beginning of this month, by House Republican leaders, and it passed a few key committees already. And if you're watching the news today or this past week, you'll know that there is a vote scheduled for today on this bill by the full House. There's not been a time set by design because we're still not sure how many votes they're going to have. They need about 216 to get it through, and there's some wrangling going on. So keep in mind as I go through this that many of the things I talk about may change. They may change in the next hour depending on what is added in terms of amendments to sweeten the deal in this case. But the bill has also faced criticism from both sides of the political aisle and within the Republican Party itself, because some say that it does too much, some say it does not do enough to repeal Obamacare, and the main reason why is to note that this bill is being passed through something called the budget reconciliation process. It's not being passed through normal legislation. So that effectively limits how many changes lawmakers can make to this bill. They only can do things that effectively affect what the budgetary process involves. And so there's a three-step process that's going to take place if Republicans have their way to get the full repeal and replace plan done. And so more on that in a bit. So the AHCA, as the new acronym is called, what are the current provisions that we should be aware of? I'm going to just go through most of them. There are a bit more here. But the big things here is that we're going to be they'll be repealing the individual and employer mandate penalties. That's a big deal. They're going to be keeping coverage for dependent children at age 26. They're going to have no exclusions allowed for people with pre-existing conditions, no annual lifetime limits. They're going to loosen requirements on health savings accounts. That was talked about a lot in the campaign. They're going to create new fixed-dollar age-adjusted tax credits for after 2020. So whereas the ACA had tax credits based on your income, the AHCA will now have tax credits based on your age. A big point of contention, of course, is the phasing out of the Medicaid expansion, which many states bought into and are now finding, whoops, the funding from the federal government is going to dry up. Hopefully they have a way to deal with that, and the truth is most states don't. So that's causing a bit of trouble for the bill. They're defunding Planned Parenthood. They're creating a stability fund for states to use for reinsurance and other purposes. And importantly as well, they're going to create a penalty for individuals who try to enroll in coverage who have not had continuous coverage, and that's a way to try to mitigate the effect of repealing the individual mandate. So the status, as I mentioned, it did pass a few committees in the past few weeks, but really today is going to be a big deal, and so I encourage all of you, if you want to watch some political fireworks tonight, tune into whatever channel you want to watch, and you'll see the House will be scrambling for votes on this bill.
And just so everyone knows, the minute we know something and how it's going to affect our industry, the self-funded space, We will be sure to either A, have a webinar, do a quick podcast, or an email blast will go out to the industry the minute we know something. Right?
Right, Adam. And so one of the big problems for the bill encountered was the release of the Congressional Budget Office report. And that's a report that comes out really on any big piece of legislation. And in this case, it gives statistics about number of people who will lose coverage, the cost involved. And I just noted a few important numbers here that 24 million people could lose coverage under AHCA. That's probably a mistake we'll see a lot going forward. But 7 million people, they estimate, would drop out of employer-sponsored coverage over the next decade. I'm going to get into that a bit more in the next few slides because of certain reasons why I think that's overblown. But it's worth noting that they made that prediction under the CBO report. As I mentioned, it's facing criticism on both sides of the aisle, but especially in the Senate, and it's more important in the Senate than it is in the House for this to pass because they need essentially every Republican senator, and all it takes is one to hold up this bill. And enough House Republicans have come out recently that the speakers had to change the bill as recently as Monday. He added something called the Manager's Amendment, which basically allowed changes to be made even after the bill came out of committee. And there were certain things added to sweeten the deal for Republicans, some of which are important for our purposes, and I'll get to in a second. But they're hoping to just push this bill through anyway and get it through to the Senate. And the earliest we would expect any action, assuming it passes tonight, it could be heard by the Senate as early as next week. And then we'll have to see, you know, what tactics the Democrats try to use to stall that process. But we're plowing along here, folks. As I said, this bill was introduced March 6th, and here we are. The month's not over yet, and this bill is well along its way from becoming law potentially.
Hey, Brady, just going to put you on the spot. What do you think is going to happen? Do you think it's going to pass today?
Wow. So, you know.
Well, I have to ask.
So there's a press conference today at 3:30 with the Speaker of the House, and he's going to update us. I know there's some wrangling going on right now between the administration and congressional Republicans where they're offering these sweet deals to various members who are still on the fence. I think if they add enough sweet deals in, it may pass, but it may be at the expense of action in the Senate because if they take away too many parts of the bill that were keeping coverage in place, like, for example, the essential health benefits, I think that senators who are more moderate will say, hey, this can't pass. And so I would expect this to pass. It would be a huge embarrassment if the biggest piece of legislation the Trump administration has yet fails in the House on the first vote. So I think this would pass, and I expect a serious rewrite in the Senate. But for now, I mentioned earlier, this is part of a three-pronged approach. And that's sort of how the administration has been selling this to people, both to members and to employer groups and other people in the industry who are skeptical. They're saying this is actually the first part in a three-part process. Step one is pass the American Health Care Act. So once that's passed, you know, we expect a rewrite of the bill. As I mentioned, what can be done is limited, mostly because of the fact that it's being done through the budget process. That leads to step two and three. Step two is providing essential regulatory and administrative relief. So we would expect this to be things like, you know, informing agencies not to enforce many existing provisions of the ACA. We've seen that a bit already with the IRS. And we would expect to see more more rules being told being not enforced rather going forward. And then finally, step three, and this is a big one, would be enacting bipartisan health care reform through legislation. Now that's the big deal. That's going to be changes that can be made to Obamacare and to this new bill legislatively. They could go beyond the budget process. That would require 60 votes in the Senate.
Would this be stuff that would actually reduce the actual cost of care?
So that's where people are looking at, yes. People are looking to step three as an opportunity to insert provisions in the bill that would actually provide more transparency with providers and potentially lower the cost of care by, who knows, maybe having, you know, negotiating drug prices and other things.
So, Brady, all the stuff you gave us is great, right? I was at a conference, and the gentleman before me that was speaking was talking about some of the things that you were talking about. As many of you know in the audience, we're a self-funded company. FIA is. So
right.
I'm sitting there going, okay, how does this affect my self-funded plan? Look at all these options we have for our employees. We obviously have to meet certain standards for essential health benefits, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's tax-free dollars that our employees don't have to pay taxes on. All these things. And I'm sitting there going, the gentleman that was speaking for an hour never mentioned at all how any of this is going to affect my self-funded plan. So one of the things, folks, that Ron and I both told Brady was, Brady, at the end of the day, the people that are listening, thousands of people that are listening on this today, want to know is, Brady, how does this affect their self-funded employees, their self-funded plans, their self-funded clients? they're self-funded administrators.
Right. So why don't you say that, Adam? I actually have a slide on just that exact topic.
Pretty good slide.
And as I mentioned before, internally, we're going to have a more on this as this develops, as the bill actually passes, as amendments are finalized. There'd be a lot more to say, but I did go through and put together a list of things that I think we could tell right now that'll have an impact on self-funding and on employer-sponsored insurance generally. So the first thing is, you know, obviously it's important to note that if we as the industry lose 7 million people off employer-sponsored insurance rolls in 10 years, that could be a big deal. So we want to look at why we think the CBO is saying that, what the thinking is there. And I can tell you that the thinking from the CBO on that point is that if you remove the individual mandate, you're going to have a lot of workers, perhaps, who will say, you know what, I don't need my employer-sponsored coverage. I'll just go without the coverage. I'm not going to get a penalty. And so one idea is that you would lose young, healthy workers from your plans. Of course, one answer to that is, well, if your employer is offering you good health insurance coverage or cheap, cost-effective coverage, you're not going to see that happen. So I think this is based on, you know, the idea that a lot of people are just looking to drop their care. We don't think that is likely to happen. And combined with the fact that you're going to have regulatory relief, you might be able to – you're going to see plans that are offered that are cheaper, that it's not so burdensome on employers to meet all these requirements. So I think you're not going to see, you know, people jumping from the rolls the way the CBO is projecting.
But the CBO projection is 7 million over the next
10 years. Right, yeah.
So that's roughly under a million a year.
Right, and so
even in a worst case scenario, as they're talking about, we're not talking about major numbers here.
No, we're not. And in fact, you know, there's reason to think that you may actually see people be added to the rolls over that time too. So that number is certainly going to change. And again, depending on what the final bill looks like, that'll impact the numbers that we expect to see moving on or off the rolls. So what changes under the current version of the AHCA? Well, I mentioned earlier that penalties under the employer mandate will be reduced to zero retroactive to 1/1/2016. Now, that's important, and that's good to know. However, keep in mind that you may see states try to enact their own employer mandates. For example, here in Massachusetts, the governor presented a budget proposal, that would have imposed a $2,000 per employee assessment on companies with 11 or more employees that didn't offer their own health care.
So, Brady, right on this, right here,
right.
You're talking about in more, quote-unquote, liberal states where they liked a lot of the pieces of Obamacare, this could be a situation where there are mandates now in place on a particular state level that employers need to be aware of, particularly municipalities, counties, you know,
right,
how to govern plans.
Right. Oftentimes we may forget this, but, you know, the federal mandates are just one part of mandates here. The states have their own rules, and we expect that, especially as Medicaid gets trimmed, and you're going to see more pressure on states. They're going to want to avoid people from jumping on the Medicaid rolls, so they're going to want to try to force employers to offer insurance.
Brady, we have a good question. What does the CBO stand for?
Sorry, that's the Congressional Budget Office, and they are supposedly a nonpartisan agency which produces budgetary reports. They analyze the effects of bills, how much they're going to cost. You know, they provide objective data for Congress. And
slides are always available right after our webinar is over on our website.
Absolutely, yep, right after. And so continuing what else is potentially going to change here, I mentioned, too, that there are going to be incentives for maintaining coverage. So you may see the individual mandate be replaced, but there will be instead a 30% surcharge imposed on you if during the prior 12 months you had a break in coverage exceeding 63 days. So that's an incentive for people to keep their coverage and not to wait till they get sick to enroll. It remains to be seen whether or not that's going to be enough to overcome the resulted adverse selection problem from removing the individual mandate. The next big thing is the Cadillac tax. The dreaded Cadillac tax is actually supposedly going to return. In one of the earlier versions of this bill, there was going to be a 10% tax on employer-sponsored plans. It was in the policy brief that leaked out last month. That's been removed. Instead, the Cadillac tax has come back, but it's been pushed out 5 more years to 2025. So the odds of this actually becoming law and taking effect are pretty slim. Many people think it's just a placeholder for now, but it's worth noting that it's there in the final bill. The next big thing is deregulation of account-based plans, something that the president mentioned a lot on the campaign trail, as he wants to expand the use of HSAs. In this case, the contribution limits would be increased to match high-deductible health plan out-of-pocket limits, and notably, spouses would be able to make catch-up contributions in the same HSA. So basically, it'll be easier for you to use your HSAs. You'll be able to put more money into them, and we expect plans that are paired with HSAs, the HDHP plans, to be more prevalent coming in the future. Finally here, and what stays the same, new tax credits. We mentioned that under the ACA, the subsidies were available based on your income, And under the AHCA, they're going to be used, they're going to be tied rather to your age. And that's facing a lot of criticism on the other side of the aisle, because for elderly people who don't make a lot of money, they would be getting more money under the ACA than they would be under the AHCA. But that's the idea the Republicans are going with for now.
That's the main concern, right?
It is.
That basically, the seniors who don't make a lot of money,
right,
the voters,
right,
the ones that actually vote, under the new AHCA, are getting penalized.
Sure, and it's relevant for our industry because you have employees who may retire at, say, 55 and not yet eligible for Medicare, and now they're not getting as much of a tax credit to help them afford insurance on their own. And that's going to be
sort of the ones who vote.
Correct, they
and
vote.
They're the ones that show up at the town hall.
And that's something that they've addressed on Monday. The speaker has, you know, realized that there's not enough help in this case, and, you know, he's providing, I think they had an 80-something million dollars slush fund produced to help people in that situation. Okay, on to what stays the same. There's obviously a lot here as well. I'll just go through this quickly. But I mentioned many times that not much is changing yet, because the fact is Congress is limited in its ability to make changes because of this budget process. Importantly, for our purposes, reporting requirements remain in effect. So we do expect to see that, you know, enforcement may be lightened over the next few years or few months, but we know that for now, employers still need to report their filing of forms and their status, compliance status. Those things will all be important. And I mentioned the others already, where dependent children staying on your plans, conditions being you have to keep coverage for those, no lifetime limits, and the requirement to cover preventive care without cost sharing. So those things are all staying the same. But as I mentioned, finally, just this is changing very quickly, folks, as we said, and we'll be, you know, certainly updating you as soon as we know what is in this final bill.
And for those of you who are going to be at the SIA conference next week in Tucson, Arizona, our VP of Consulting, Jen McCormick, will be speaking regarding plan design, plan drafting, so forth, as well as what's going on with the AHCA, a.k.a. Trump Care. And we're going to turn it over to John. John, let's talk about plan negotiations and focus on the big picture items here, on things that people want to do and should do.
Yeah, well, thank you for that, Brady. That was a lot of great information. And as Adam mentioned, these slides will be available to print, and this webinar will be available to view or listen to likely later today. So you'll get an email for that if you have registered for today's webinar. Now, on to a topic that we have all been looking into lately, claim negotiations. What exactly is a claim negotiation? That bullet is extremely relevant because it really depends on who you ask and who you're talking to. So a better question might be, what is not a claim negotiation? If your plan is out of network and you pay a provider without any kind of contract, there's no paper, there's no conversation about fees, you just cut a check, that is not a claim negotiation. There's been no negotiation. You haven't spoken to the provider hasn't indicated a sense to accept a certain amount. So what is a claim negotiation then? Well, we had an issue a couple of months back where essentially a client of ours wanted to negotiate an in-network claim, where, and by the way, we will talk about that in greater detail on the next slide, but a client wanted to negotiate an in-network claim. So we reached out to the provider, and the provider said, we already have a negotiation. And the provider copied the client on that email, and the client came to us frantically and said, we haven't negotiated this claim. We haven't even spoken to the provider. And I went to the provider, and I kind of asked what they meant when they said they had a negotiated they had already negotiated the claim. And the provider said, well, we have a PPO contract. And our client, a broker, was adamant that the PPO contract was not a claim negotiation. It was a negotiated rate. But when our client thought of negotiation, they absolutely just discounted a PPO contract and said it wasn't a negotiation. Well, folks, it is a negotiation. A claim negotiation is any rate that a provider has agreed to accept. Prepayment, postpayment, in a contract, in a one-off claim, a narrow network, anything, absolutely anything that a provider has agreed to accept is a negotiated rate, and that's a claim negotiation. Now, why do I bring this up? Why is it important to know exactly what is a claim negotiation? Well, that's a great question, right? Because when you're dealing with claims and medical providers and rates that need to be paid, all you have to look at is the plan document for out-of-network claims, and for in-network claims or otherwise negotiated rates, you have to look at whatever was negotiated. Like I said, whether it's a contract, a written contract, or an oral promise just made over the phone, anything like that needs to be examined when deciding how much to pay on a claim. And this is, of course, I keep saying that we're going to get to in-network and out-of-network distinctions. We will. Be patient. But first, it makes sense to talk about stop-loss and plan language. I cannot stress enough, and we have been saying this for years, when you are doing anything, whether it's negotiating claims or reference-based pricing or carve-outs, whether dialysis, hemophilia, etc., it's imperative to have plan language that supports what you want to do. If you don't have good plan language, you don't have an end game. The reason an end game is important because there are many medical providers out there who don't want to negotiate. If you call them and you say, this claim is too high, let's make a deal, they might say, no, thank you, and hang up on you. Even if they don't hang up, they still might say, no, thank you. Some of them are a little more cordial. Some of them will make counteroffers. But if they are billing at something like 1,000% of Medicare and they offer 5% off their bill charges, that's not very helpful to anyone, is it? So having an end game is of the utmost importance because the plan needs to be able to give up on a negotiation if the provider is too stubborn and say, fine, we haven't been able to negotiate. You're going to get paid what our plan document says you're going to get paid. It's also very important because when you go into a negotiation, if you just politely ask a medical provider to lower its rate, there's a good chance that they're going to say, well, why should we? And the answer to that is because if you don't, our plan language specifies that you will receive much, much, much less than you would get with this negotiation. That is called an end game. That is where you have leverage. If your plan language isn't good, if your plan language just says, basically, we will pay you your bill charges, then the provider has every right and incentive to demand those bill charges. And if you went to court, you had better believe that they're going to get those bill charges. Well, stop loss is also a major component in this bullet. And there are certain carriers who include standard language in their policies that basically says, if a claim is negotiated, we will pay that negotiated rate. We will consider that negotiated rate to be an eligible expense under the stop loss policy. And of course, when you're negotiating rates, it's always going to be a rate greater than what the plan allows, because if it was less than what the plan allows, there's kind of no reason to negotiate.
Right.
So if you're paying more than the plan, or more than what the plan language rather says, you need to be in the same page as your stop-loss carrier and make sure that they are okay with that additional payment. Otherwise, you could be really left in the lurch on a spec claim if it's paid greater than what the carrier expects it to be paid.
And this is something that we can obviously look for when we do a gap analysis between the stop-loss contract and the plan document. So it's great information that John has just shared with you. But I think a key piece here, John, because I know we're talking about in and out of in-network versus out-of-network on the next slide, and we should probably go right to it, is people believing that you can treat in-network claims the same as you can on out-of-network claims when it comes to claim negotiations, and that's just not true.
Yeah. You're absolutely right. On the subject of in-network versus out-of-network, for any of you who were at the SPBA conference last week, Tim Callender and I touched a little bit about in-network and out-of-network negotiations when we talked about PPO contracts in our breakout session. And a lot of this was covered then, but it's worth reiterating because we frequently get questions about this and requests for in-network negotiations. And basically, people need to know what's what, kind of when to stop, when to give up, what you can and can't do. So these four bullets here kind of all tie into one another. There are a lot of medical providers out there who are willing to negotiate beyond rates pre-negotiated with a PPO. The reasons for that include fair market value, guilt over the amounts charged, and being forced to bill patients for the remainder. I mean, there are a lot of reasons, and it's the same reason that anyone agrees to a lower fee for anything. But basically, if a provider is willing to negotiate beyond its PPO rate, fantastic. We absolutely recommend trying to do that because, heck, why not? The worst a provider can say is, we already have a contract. We're not going to negotiate. Now, sometimes it makes sense to push and really try to get a negotiation. But if you're dealing with a large national network, maybe one of the BUCAs, maybe you're dealing with Cigna, if the provider says, we won't negotiate, it might be best to just stand down.
If the provider brings up the network contract, it's probably a good time to back off because, again, you have to look at who your clientele is. If we're working with a
TPA owned by a hospital system or a TPA owns a network, probably don't want to negotiate those claims. But it all comes down to, and the great point, when to stop pushing. Many times you can make that decision whether to push or not or how far to push before you even start anything. Just look at the scenario you're in to make that determination.
Yeah, thanks. And it's worth noting that here at the FIA Group, for those of you who know us very well, you know that we deal with tons and tons of different issues spanning every corner of the self-funded universe. Have we seen a network boot out a plan for non-compliance? Absolutely.
Yes.
Is it common? Of course not. But does it happen? Absolutely.
Sometimes the network contracts actually allow them to boot a TPA and or plan for no reason. They can just boot them. And they use that as leverage as to, hey, stop pushing or we're just going to kick you out because we have the right just to kick you out.
Right. And this is actually not something I've seen, and I hope that I never see it. I hope that none of us ever see this. But for many network contracts, they are signed by the TPA, and regardless of who the payer is, right, as long as the TPA signs the contract, very often the network reserves the right to boot the entire TPA in the event of any payer's noncompliance. So that's all our worst nightmares, right, that your entire block of business would be booted from network, from the network, and lose network access because one stubborn payer doesn't feel like paying the network rate. That's a disaster, and it really puts a lot of responsibility on the TPA to make sure that payers, that individual plans, are well aware of their rights and responsibilities. So if you have a client who wants to not pay the network rate and basically wants to stick it to the man, you need to look at the facts. You need to really examine everything that's going on to make sure that you are not damaging your entire block of business.
So we're getting a lot of questions in regards to the whole negotiation piece, and Ron's going to bring up, answer a lot of these questions when we tie into reference-based pricing, because a lot of it just all flows together. But speaking of reference-based pricing, before I turn it over to Ron, and Ron, you've been very quiet today, which is great. I think he has laryngitis or something. But, you know, it says how to do it right. Folks, most people don't really understand what it is. Pure RBP is no network at all. But there are plenty different variations of reference-based pricing. So we see many plans that have a physician-only network where reference-based pricing is only on hospital claims. A majority of our plan docs we see are that way, where, you know, 10% of all claims are hospital claims. Less than that are hospital claims. Most are physician. It is very rare, not rare, but for most of the reference-based pricing plans that we see, you don't see pure RVP, where every claim is paid based on a reference-based price tied to Medicare or some type of equivalent. And that's it. Typically, what we have noticed, the best reference-based pricing plans end up turning into direct contracts with facilities based on some agreed-upon reference-based price. But the only way you get that is by doing it right. So I'm going to turn it over to our expert here on RBP and a lot of other things, too, Ron Peck. Ron?
Great. Thank you, Adam. I don't know what those other things are, but I'm very confident I'm an expert in them. But as far as reference-based pricing is concerned, you know what's interesting to me about reference-based pricing versus the claim negotiation that John just talked about? I think the big difference is, and I'm sure you've heard it before, that it's easier to beg forgiveness than ask permission. You know, claim negotiation is asking permission. Claim comes in. We haven't paid it yet. We're going to the provider. We're asking what we could do about the claim. Whereas with reference-based pricing, and I think this is where a lot of the controversy or some of the conflicts come up, is the begging forgiveness. And by that, what I mean is the plan is already deciding what they're going to pay. They pay a certain amount based on Medicare, based on some other objective reference, some other parameters that they use to determine the payable amount, and then they cross their fingers and hope that the provider will accept it as payment in full. And it's only when there's pushback, when there's noise, that all of a sudden we all scramble. But because the money's already been paid, it creates much more controversy. But regardless of whether we're talking about reference-based pricing, claim negotiation, carve-outs, partial, full, it doesn't matter. The same rules always apply. And the number one issue that we keep seeing, despite the fact that this is the simplest golden rule when it comes to implementing not only reference-based pricing, but any cost containment program, medical tourism, carve-outs, you name it, wellness programs, is you have to adjust the language. And I'm not just talking about the SPD. Obviously, the plan document, in my mind, is the most important thing to adjust. But you also need to make sure that the ID cards, that they reflect the way the plan is actually run. the stop loss policy needs to coordinate with and reflect the plan's process. Network contracts, if there are networks in play, make sure that you coordinate with them. EOBs reflect the plan. Notification of adverse benefits determination, right? If we're paying less than the charge amount or we're denying a claim, we need to explain it in a way that matches the plan terms. Everything needs to match. You know, one of the things I just mentioned and is really important to me is the ID card, because ultimately, if you're the provider, that's really the only thing that you're seeing is the ID card, right? So, let's say I have a plan document that says I'm going to pay claims based on Medicare. Okay, great, that's in the plan document. Do you really think the provider is flipping through a 100-page document to find that language? No, they're looking at the ID card, which happens to feature a logo from a network. So put yourself in the shoes of that provider. You see that network logo. What do you think? That the network applies. It's called detrimental reliance. They're going to use it against you. So I've seen some interesting ideas out there, for instance, where if you have a carve-out, let's say for dialysis, people issue literally cards specifically for dialysis. So we'll talk a little bit more about carve-outs in a second. But when we talk about the attitude that you're going to take getting into this, and we're talking full reference-based pricing, you need to be ready for a fight, and you need to understand what the plan's perspective or stance is on those conflicts. Are they willing to fight the fight, or if there's pushback, do they want to negotiate and make it go away? Agree on your approach ahead of time. This also applies to knowing your audience. This not only applies to the plan sponsor, the employer, but it also applies to the employees. Do they understand this approach? Do they understand how it's creating savings? Are they ready to work with their employer and the service provider and their administrator? The providers in the area, that's also an audience. Is there a lot of competition between hospitals? Are there some that are looking for steerage and they're willing to work with you, work with this type of plan? Or is it a unified front against you?
One of the things you really want to focus on is knowing the geography, knowing where your plan is located.
Absolutely.
One of the key things is going to be, how much do we actually pay? So we know from all the studies that if you reimburse, and this is national, if you're reimbursing at 120% of Medicare, your appeal rate, your balanced bill rate is going to be 30% of the claims. Whereas if you're paying at 165, 170% of Medicare, your appeals rate is going to be 1%. So, again, look at your area. Look at what those facilities are getting. Is there a hospital there in town where 80% of their people are Medicare only or Medicaid patients, where they'll be excited to have Medicare plus 130? All that needs to be taken into effect from a language pricing and the advocacy standpoint to have the right type of reference-based pricing approach.
Regarding pricing, Adam, you also need to make sure if your program is going to work that it's defensible data. And finally, you need to make sure everything is decided preemptively, the language, the approach, if someone's balanced bills, who do they call, what do we do. That all needs to be agreed to ahead of time. Run through the hypotheticals before it actually happens. And when we look at how you do it wrong, that's the exact opposite, right? When we look at how you do it wrong, that's where we're reactive instead of proactive, right? We wait until collections. Listen, it costs the provider a lot of money to balance bill patients and even more to send them to collections. If they've already invested that cost, that ship has sailed. They're not going to go back and now negotiate, so you want to try and nip it in the bud. Ignoring contracts. Let me stop and explain something at a higher level. Frequently people ask, if my plan document says ABC, and I have a contract that says XYZ, doesn't the plan document control?
A network contract.
A network contract. Doesn't my plan document control?
No.
The problem you're going to run into, and I see this all the time, I've literally had a network or a provider say, the plan wants to comply with the plan document and ignore the contract? Sure, go ahead. The plan can pay what the plan pays. We'll just sue the employer for the rest. We'll sue the TPA for the rest. It's an enforceable contract. You can't say that you have one deal and then go and execute another contract and then say, oops, my bad, I didn't have a right to execute that contract because of that pre-existing plan document. They're going to get you one way or another. It's the same way if I tried to sell you Adam's car. You honestly and reasonably believe I have a right to sell you Adam's car. I take your money, when you ask for the keys, I say, oops, it's not my car, it's Adam's car. I didn't have a right to do it.
My favorite are the stop-loss policies who rightfully mirror the plan. But the plan isn't following the plan because the plan is following a network contract. These are all convoluted things that we could spend hours on. The number of questions we're getting, folks, we're not going to have time to get back to you all. we will make sure that we do it. But we want to make sure we talk about a little bit about partial reference-based pricing. This is where the big issues happen. Typically, years down the line, we're going to go over the horror stories in a bit. But really, folks, these are some good things. You want to carve out dialysis. Everyone does. You want to carve out hemophilia, specialty drugs, drugs altogether, all the different things. There's two pieces. One, is it legal? Is it compliant? That whole piece. Second, do you have other contracts out there that literally say the opposite of what you're trying to do, and those contracts are enforceable? We call those PPO pitfalls. 50% of the questions that we're being asked right now on this webinar relate to that. Hey, Adam, we want to do this and this. We're being asked one-sentence questions where we know there's a lot more to it. We need to see the actual agreements. What does it actually say you agreed to do? So, again, you might have a good reason to do it. You might have good intentions, but can you? And that's why, and John, I want you to test a couple seconds on FIA Unwrapped, what we do on that. On FIA Unwrapped, we know there is no outside contract you're agreeing to because we're replacing that outside contract.
Right. With traditional reference-based pricing, in theory, there is no contract. But as Adam mentioned in the beginning, there are a lot of different types of reference-based pricing. There are narrow networks. There are physician-only networks. There are a lot of moving parts. FIA Unwrapped is designed as an out-of-network claim methodology that doesn't use contracts, it doesn't use wrap networks, it doesn't use anything. It prices claims based on a percentage of Medicare, and then there's patient advocacy and back-end balance billing support. None of the headache of dealing with a PPO, none of the headache of specific service carve-outs. This is just anything that is non-contracted. And I actually want to back up for a second and touch on something that Adam mentioned before, the PPO pitfalls. I mentioned stop loss earlier when talking about claim negotiations, and it is absolutely relevant here. Stop loss can really make or break a self-funded plan when it comes to reference-based pricing, or especially partial reference-based pricing. So take the extremely common example, actually, of a plan that decides to pay one particular service at 150% of Medicare, or some number, whatever number it is, right? It's essentially less than the network rate. And the plan puts in the best plan language there is. It's totally defensible under the plan. The plan goes and gets stop-loss coverage, and stop-loss underwrites the plan using that 150 or whatever percent of Medicare. But then, there's a network contract. And the plan says, but my plan says 150% of Medicare. And the provider and the network say, well, we don't care. You signed the contract. Just like Ron said, you're going to butt heads there, and instead of one trumping the other, the fact is they're two separate and competing responsibilities, and technically you have to comply with both. It's a nightmare. It's absolutely a nightmare. But keep in mind that stop loss said 150% of Medicare.
Well, speaking of nightmare, you talked about horror shows, horror stories here.
Yeah, and this ties in well, and I was actually just about to tell a horror story, and that's perfect. But when the plan pays 150% of Medicare, and stop loss agrees to reimburse it based on that 150% of Medicare, if the plan ends up being forced, having no choice but to pay the PPO rate of, say, 900% of Medicare, well, what's stop loss doing about that other 750? They're denying it. Most carriers will absolutely deny that. Of course, there are certain carriers that will be very sympathetic, but the best chance of getting stop loss to cover these claims is by letting them know what's going on the front end. If there's one lesson that we at the FIA Group have tried to impart through the years, it's be transparent with stop loss, make sure they know what's going on. Because as we know, right, if a self-funded health plan, say a 50-employee company has to pay $40 million for premature triplets, and we saw that, it's going to go bankrupt, and there's not going to be any option, which is why stop loss is so important, which is why making sure your stop loss carrier knows what's going on is so important. So, horror stories. That was number one. My favorite one, actually, and this happened just a few weeks after I started with the FIA Group, and it kind of threw me headfirst into the industry, which is great. The plan ignored its PPO and instead used reference-based pricing for facility claims. They basically said, we are going to pay 140% of Medicare for everything. And then somebody came back and said, but what about this fun nifty contract that we signed that has your signature on it? This is your signature, yes? The plan said, yeah, but we don't want to do that anymore. We think it's a bad contract. The rates are too high. We're going to do reference-based pricing instead. Well, guess what? That was a long, long lawsuit. And the plan lost. You sign contracts. You have to pay based on those contracts. If you've got permission from the network or if the contracts allow it, you can do other things. You can use cost containment. But in general, those contracts are not going to allow you to do that. So be very, 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 very careful when you're looking at ways to contain costs, because if there are contracts that contradict those ways to contain costs, it's going to be a headache every time. And really quickly, reference-based pricing without good plan language can be a killer. Ron mentioned that plan language is imperative, and I mentioned it earlier. If you don't have the language, you don't have the rights, period.
How about the throwing members under the bus? What's that about?
Yeah, well, that's a good one. And actually, we presented, I believe, two full webinars. One was an hour and a half about the concept of reference-based pricing and the Department of Labor's guidance. And basically, in a very, very small nutshell, and I'm just going to try to go through this quickly because it does get very complicated. The DOL has come out and said that for reference-based pricing plans, when there is no network, if patients have no choice but to visit facilities that will balance bill them, the plan is not allowed to let that happen. It gets very complicated, but the underlying premise is simple. Health plans are not allowed to not give patients options. You need to give patients options to visit medical providers, whether it's facilities or physicians, who are not going to balance bill. If you don't give them any options, you are legally obligated to settle claims and make sure that patients don't get sued and go to collections on every claim.
So we're getting even more questions in regards to this. And again, you know, reference-based pricing claim after runouts expired is stop-loss responsible. Well, we would have told you that if you have a reference-based pricing plan, you shouldn't let stop-loss expire because there is no network. Therefore, there shouldn't be any rule in regards to, you know, when they might come back and get you because you don't get sign-off on these claims. That's the thing. With reference-based pricing, there is no sign-off, right? With the network contract, there is sign-off on every claim. Big difference. So you can't expose yourself forever. But again, most of the questions we're getting, if we don't have a copy of the plan doc and if we don't have a copy of the actual network and or stop-loss contracts, we really can't give you a full answer that can appease you. Ron, let's get into overpayments. Hopefully we don't get another 30. I mean, this guy is the most questions we've ever received ever in any webinar.
Half of them are questions. Half of them are people screaming.
But in 5 minutes that we have left, Ron, let's go over the overpayments and tell people what's next month.
So overpayments. Listen, overpayments generally come from one of what I call the three P's of healthcare: the patient, the payer, or the provider. And overpayments can come up from any three. We are familiar with overpayments that arise from the payer, all right? These are claims processing issues. And this is why I think a lot of people are embarrassed or afraid to pursue refunds on overpayments, because they don't want to admit they made a mistake. But I believe, and many believe, that you do have a fiduciary duty to identify and pursue recovery of overpayments. And if someone determines that this money was out there and you could have potentially recovered it for the plan, trust me, that's a lot worse than the initial mistake that resulted in the overpayment in the first place. So identify and pursue the overpayments. Don't get emotional or be embarrassed. Secondly, it's been said that when you pursue an overpayment, a refund, it's no different than a denial. It's an adverse benefit determination. If I'm a hospital and I send you a bill for $5,000 and you deny it, I'm looking at it and saying, okay, you're not going to pay me. If you pay me and then ask for the money back, it's the same end result, so treat it the same way. When we look at things like fault and reasons for refunds, like I said before, it's not just the payer, it's also the provider and the patient. And for that reason, you cannot be embarrassed and you have to go ahead and pursue the overpayments. Now, we're familiar with things like processing errors and incorrect discounts, determinations of medical necessity, duplicate billing. Duplicate billing, right, that could potentially be something that if you want to assign fault or blame, that could have been the provider's fault, but it also could be the payer's fault for failing to notice it in the first place. But it's better that you notice it at some point than you let it go indefinitely. Claim payment, PPO audits, these are all things that could result in overpayments. But also remember things like fraud, misrepresentation. I can't tell you how many times I've dealt with an overpayment where a plan member was supposedly a spouse of the employee, and they only later discovered that they had falsified that. I'm pretty sure that was a Kevin James and Adam Sandler movie, right? So, but again, those claims are overpayments. You didn't do anything wrong. The only thing that you could do that would be wrong is not pursuing the overpayment in the first place. And as an employer and someone who is an administrator of our own self-funded plan, let me tell you, if my TPA told me that they made an overpayment but they're working to get the money back, I'm going to be a lot happier with them than if they told me that, oh, that overpayment, we never pursued it. We didn't want you to know we made a mistake.
So what Ron really wants to tell you is just to send your overpayment claims to us.
That's what I'm saying without saying it, Adam.
So, again, we have 1 minute left. We just want to have everyone to know. Again, we will respond to each one of you. Some of you now are typing in all caps. We get it. We know you're upset. We know that you have a lot of questions you want us to answer. We'll get to it. Our next webinar, April 27, 2017. Again, please go to LinkedIn, look up the FIA group, follow us. What we also want you to do is we have a really good idea of what we want to talk about at our next webinar. But we want you to tell us what you want us to talk about as well on our next webinar. So please go on LinkedIn, follow us, and tell us, hey, FIA, follow. We want you to focus on this topic next month. It's pretty clear to me, if I look at anything, just from the questions that we're having, people are having a big issue dealing with carve-outs. People are having a major issue on, I have reference-based pricing on some stuff, some network contracts on some other things. I have stop loss issues relating to all this. How can you help us? Air ambulance claims, etc. We'll do our best. But for now, on behalf of John, great job on the negotiations. Ron on the overpayments. Brady on the great work on the Trump. And myself on everything else. Thank you so much for listening to us for the past hour. We're very humbled by the fact that thousands of you listen to us every single month. We will see you next time. And again, don't forget to follow us on LinkedIn. Thank you.